Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society.
Well, today I'm going to deviate from our usual format because I'm going to try to answer some of the mountains of emails that I've been getting specifically about the coronavirus, which has gripped the entire planet Earth. It's projected that a good fraction of the entire human race will eventually be infected by the virus. And of course, hundreds of millions of people have already had their lives turned upside down because of this pandemic. Now, first of all, let me say that I'm not a medical doctor. I do not have an MD degree. I have a PhD in theoretical physics, but I am quite familiar with the computer modeling, which is now being done at the highest levels of governments and medical institutes. So today we're going to talk about the science of the coronavirus. And once again, if you have a question about the coronavirus, you think you may have symptoms, then of course, consult your local physician. And in a worst case, call 911 and get emergency help. But again, I'm not a medical doctor, but today we're going to talk about the science or lack of science behind the coronavirus. Well, one question that I often get is, well, where did it come from? It just jumped out of nowhere within a matter of weeks. All of a sudden, it gripped the entire population of the planet. And if we understand where it came from, perhaps we can understand whether it could happen again, all over again. Well, first of all, we sometimes forget the fact that most diseases, in fact, roughly 60% of all diseases, ultimately originate from the animal kingdom. That's right. They infect other animals for millions of years, then suddenly they mutate and hop over and infect humans. But there's a new factor in this equation, and that is that humans are encroaching upon the ancient grounds of animals. You see, humans are quite young as a race. We're only about 100,000, maybe 200,000 years old. Animals, of course, are millions, hundreds of millions of years old. And so we have to realize that the precursor of these viruses and diseases are ancient. These are ancient diseases that are slowly mutating and infecting other animals until two things happen. One, humans begin to encroach upon the territory inhabited by these ancient viruses for perhaps millions of years. And second, they mutate. They mutate, so instead of infecting other animals, they hop over and start to infect humans. Now, take a look at the flu, for example. Even though the coronavirus is much more dangerous than the flu, we can sort of understand the nature of diseases by looking at the genetics, the DNA and the RNA within these viruses. First of all, we realize that when we sequence the genome of the flu, the Hong Kong flu, the Shanghai flu, the Beijing flu, we find basically the genes of ducks and pigs. Because you see, in Asia, not just China, but throughout Asia, there's something called polyfarming. Polyfarming is where the farmers live in very close proximity to animals such as pigs and birds, specifically ducks. And so what happens is the viruses originate perhaps in ducks, and then the pigs eat the bird droppings, and then we eat the pigs. So that the pigs become a genetic mixing bowl, mixing genes, fragments of genes from birds, pigs, and yes, even humans. And that's why we have so many different kinds of viruses, influenzas, coming from Asia. Now, some people say that, well, maybe we should disrupt this cycle of living so close to the animal kingdom. And that's, of course, where many of these genes hop over, these viruses hop over. Take a look at HIV, for example. Its genome is still being studied, but there is a theory a theory which says that HIV, its precursors, are actually quite ancient, millions of years old, in the form of something called SIV, or the simian, not the human, but the simian version of HIV. Again, it's a very old virus. It infects other monkeys and other apes, and it's been that way for millions of years until humans began to encroach upon the territory of the apes, in fact, eat them, and it mutated, hopped over to humans, and according to the theory, that's the origin of the HIV crisis. And so we have to realize that, well, maybe the coronavirus has a very similar origin. You have to realize that in Wuhan, where we think the virus originated from, there is an exotic food market, a market that deals with exotic foods that are common in Asia, but not so common in the West. And specifically, there are bats, specifically horseshoe bats. And if you sequence the genes of the coronavirus, you find that it's basically a bat genome, the horseshoe bat. And we think that it hopped over to the pangolin, which is a mammal, that then incubated its virus, and then it mutated and began to infect humans. So again, this is a theory, but it's a theory that seems to be borne out by looking at the genetics behind this whole thing. And so once again, we have to realize that in some sense, it was inevitable. Inevitable that we have these pandemics, because we live in close proximity to animals. We trade in animals. We use medicines out of animals. We eat these animals, and we pay a price for that. And that is sometimes in these exotic food markets, you have viruses like the horseshoe bat virus that can mutate and then hop over to humans. And so this means that it's inevitable. Inevitable that it will happen again. If you look at history, going back thousands of years, you realize that the plague was a scourge of our ancestors. Our ancestors had to deal with these ancient plagues. And we'll say a few things more about that as well. So once again, if you take a look at the genome of these viruses, you begin to realize where they came from and what measures we can take to restrict the hopping over of these mutated viruses that then could infect humans. And then the next question is, well, some conspiracy theorists say that maybe it's a plot. Maybe somebody weaponized this coronavirus, because coronaviruses have been around for a while. They're not new. Maybe somebody engineered this virus. Some people think that, well, maybe it was the Chinese. Maybe it was the United States Army. Well, scientists have sequenced the genes, molecule for molecule, of the coronavirus, and they've come to certain kinds of conclusions. First of all, this conspiracy theory started because in the city of Wuhan, where we have this exotic animal market, we also have two institutes, not one, but two institutes devoted to the study of these viruses. And sure enough, they were also experimenting on horseshoe viruses. Aha, says the theorist. And then there was an article published that seemed to indicate this, but it was on the web and it was taken down. But the article did say that perhaps it escaped. This virus escaped from one of the laboratories in Wuhan. Well, to settle the whole question, scientists have sequenced molecule for molecule, gene for gene, what the coronavirus is all about. And here's what they found. First of all, look at the shape of the virus. It's rather unusual looking. In fact, it gets its name from the word corona. Corona is the halo surrounding a luminous body, for example, the sun. And so we have the sun with all its flares coming out, and that's where the word corona comes from for the coronavirus. But that's very important because these spikes that emanate from the sphere, the coronavirus, are called protein spikes. And these protein spikes are the key the key to understand why it's so deadly and so infectious. First of all, these spikes latch on to docking sites of our cells. Now, our cells have to have nutrients, important molecules coming in, and so it has docking sites allowing good chemicals to come in. However, viruses take advantage of that weakness. These protein spikes latch on to the docking site, specifically the ACE docking site, and they latch on to our cells, especially in our nose and in our lungs. And then there are two genes that make this virus so deadly. One gene allows the spike protein emanating from the surface of the virus to latch on to the docking site of your cell. There's a second gene, like a can opener, that then rips open the surface of the cell and then allowing the virus to then inject its genetic material into your cell, infecting it. And then it hijacks the machinery of your cell so that it makes copies, hundreds of copies of itself. And then later the cell wall ruptures, releasing hundreds of copies of these viruses. That's why it grows exponentially, starting with just one molecule, one virus. You could then have hundreds in one generation in a few minutes, and then after that, 100 times 100 times 100 times 100, and pretty soon you're sneezing and you're being sent to the hospital. And so what scientists found by analyzing these two genes is the fact that it's a novel virus. The mutations, a series of them, were unexpected. Now, if you are an agent of a rogue government that want to weaponize the coronavirus, this is not how you would approach it. You would have taken one of the SARS viruses, for example, tweaked it a little bit, and then experimentally tried to weaponize it that way. This is a marked departure. Several different novel mutations. So it's quite different from the previous coronaviruses. So much so that scientists who have looked at it have scratched their heads and said, nope, this is not the creation of a malicious, malevolent government. This was Mother Nature, that is, evolution. Now, does that rule out the fact that it might have been engineered? No. Perhaps somebody was a genius that was able to tinker with several genes in order to weaponize this thing. You can't rule it out totally. But the consensus within the scientific community is that it's quite novel. And it's something that you would not have expected if you were to try to deliberately then try to weaponize this virus. And then the other question is, why did it catch the scientific community totally off guard? Within a matter of a month, it mutated into something from something that was perhaps harmless into something that has gripped all the nations of the world. Well, we now realize that scientists may have underestimated several things. First of all, its lethality, that is, what percent of the population actually dies from it. But most important, how it spreads. We now realize that about 25% of people who are infected but do not have any symptoms whatsoever, 25% of infected people are asymptomatic, and they're spreaders. They can spread the virus, and we now realize that perhaps scientists underestimated, perhaps, the way in which this virus can spread. Usually we think of the virus being spread by coughing, which creates droplets, and the virus then hitchhikes on these little water droplets, which are quite large. But there's something called aerosols. Now think of perfume. If you were to spray perfume in one corner of the room, then the entire room eventually fills up with perfume. That's the difference between these droplets and aerosols, like smoke and perfume. Originally, it was thought that perhaps all we had to worry about is these droplets of water, in which case 6 feet is fine. But now people are saying, wait a minute, perhaps this virus is a little bit smarter than we thought. And perhaps, just perhaps, it can hitchhike on aerosols. And sure enough, when you go to a hospital where you have coronavirus victims and you analyze the air that is in the room, the air that surrounds the hallways, bingo, you find that there is evidence of the genetic material of the coronavirus far beyond the 6 feet. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that the 6 feet recommendation is bad. It just means that people should exercise a little bit more caution because most of it is perhaps concentrated in non-aerosol form, but you can't dismiss the fact that it is basically but some of it is transferred through aerosols. Now, why is it that certain countries have been able to get a handle on this and other countries have not and are being overwhelmed? Well, we don't know. A lot of it has to do with lateness in terms of social distancing, lateness in terms of lackness about testing. But there's some other theories coming out as well. First of all, why is it that some people have more serious symptoms than others? This is a mystery because, as I mentioned, 25% of infected people have no symptoms whatsoever. So why is it that it's severe in some cases and practically non-existent in other cases? Well, we don't know. But there's several theories being proposed. One is that the total amount of exposure influences the eventual severity of your symptoms. In other words, if you're at a dinner party, a funeral, a wedding, and for hours you're being exposed to people who are emanating clouds of these viruses, then perhaps you could come down with a pretty severe case of it. But let's say you simply bypass somebody on the street and you're only exposed to the virus for a few seconds. Well, it turns out if you look at other viruses besides the coronavirus, it turns out that, yes, there is a correlation between the amount of exposure and the severity of its symptoms. So that could be perhaps one of several reasons why some people have a very severe case and other people have hardly any cases at all. Now, is there any good news concerning the virus, given the fact that it has already infected hundreds of thousands of people? Is there any good news in all of this? Well, yeah, there's several. First of all, the rate of hospitalization is slowing down in many countries. That is, we're still witnessing the surge. We're witnessing this exponential rise in the number of people being infected, but the rate at which you are being infected is slowing down. The doubling time, for example. In some countries, the doubling time for hospitalization is about 2 days. Every 2 days, the number of hospitalizations doubles. That is an enormous exponential rise. But then a few days later, it's 3 days, then 4 days, and 6 days between doubling times. And that's good news. It does mean that you are still climbing the mountaintop, but you can see the top of the mountain. It eludes you. The top of the mountain is still way in the distance, but you can actually see it, while before you could not see it at all. And also there's some unexpected news, and that is there's a company called Kinsa Company, which manufactures thermometers which are connected to the internet. This is rather interesting because you can now track the rate at which infections take place by computer in real time. Now, you realize that the data that governments get is weeks old. And so the numbers you see do not represent the true number of people infected. The numbers you see on TV are the people that 2 weeks ago, let's say, were infected by the virus. So the numbers you get are always late. However, fevers react pretty quick to the time at which you are infected. And so this company, using computer technology, can actually see where you have the beginnings of an outbreak by simply looking at the rise in thermometers that it has sold by the hundreds of thousands around the United States. And sure enough, when you correlate the outbreaks of fevers with the outbreak of the virus itself because of hospitalizations, you find that the outbreaks can first be seen by thermometers on the internet up to 2 weeks before you see it in the evening news. And so that gives us a little bit of a head start in terms of understanding where the next outbreak, where the next tragedy could emerge. Another piece of good news is the fact that a therapy which is 100 years old is now being reanalyzed. And this is antibody injections. Now, let me explain. 100 years ago, when scientists really did not understand the nature of disease, it was thought that, well, your body does have defenses against disease in your plasma, which is in your blood. So whatever it is that is protecting you, perhaps we can inject that fluid, that plasma, into somebody else who is undergoing the infection, and perhaps you can control it. Yes, 100 years ago, it was tried out. This is called antibody therapies, and it's being tried out right now. Because of the fact that 80, 90% of people who are infected will eventually come out smelling like a rose, and so they have antibodies circulating in their plasma, which are protecting them. That's why when you get a viral infection, usually you cannot get it twice, because you have antibodies circulating in your plasma, in your blood, that protect you. So why not extract it? Why not extract it and then inject it into somebody who has all the symptoms of coronavirus? And that's being looked at, which is quite interesting. And then we have the fact that about 80 other different kinds of enzymes, chemicals, and therapies are being experimented with, which is a good sign. But then you may say to yourself, what's taking them so long? If we have 80 different kinds of therapies being looked at, then how come this thing is still out of control? For that matter, look at a vaccine. The vaccine could ultimately be the way to control this virus. Why is it going to take 12 to 18 years to perfect a vaccine? Well, you have to realize that vaccines take three different phases in order to become accepted by the scientific community. In phase one, first of all, you have to show that it works at all. You don't want snake oil. You want to have evidence, concrete evidence, the fact that it does work. That takes time. You have to test it, double-blind studies on people. And so once you test it on people, then you have to look for side effects. Perhaps if you have millions of the vaccines produced and later you find out that the vaccine causes cancer, oops, you've disinfected millions of people with cancer. And so number two, you have to look at side effects. That takes time. It takes months for side effects to show up, if at all. And then three, the vaccine has to be universal. You don't want it just to cure people of a certain race, a certain nationality, a certain gender, a certain region. No, you want it to be universal. And so that, again, takes time. And so for these reasons, we don't expect a vaccine to emerge anytime soon. And then that begs the next question. How is it going to end? What is the end game to all of this? Where is it headed? Well, the short answer is we don't know. But there have been theories proposed by scientists by looking at other diseases, other outbreaks, and looking at the past. So, first of all, there are several theories as to what the end game looked like. One theory is called herd immunity. And that is Well, why not let it infect the herd? It's going to infect the human race anyway. Perhaps it'll eventually affect 80%, 70% of the entire human race, especially if we do nothing. And that 80% will be immune, to the virus. And so the virus essentially cures itself. It infects so many people that they become immune to the disease and the disease peters out. Well, yeah, that's one possibility. But realize that the mortality rate of the virus is 1 to 2%, depending upon which figures you use, which means that take the entire population of the human race, take 80% of that, and then multiply it by 1 to 2%, and you realize that millions will die under this scenario called herd immunity. Well, the second alternative, of course, is the one that everyone wants, and that is a vaccine. Of course, as I mentioned, it'll take 12 to 18 months to perfect a vaccine, which has to be tested without side effects, and it has to be universal. That takes time. But there's also a third possibility. And the third possibility is, well, it's related to herd immunity. And that is that eventually the virus mutates to become less lethal because it has already killed off. The virus by that time has already killed off the weaker elements of society. Most people have an immunity to it. And so the virus has to either mutate or disappear. If it does not mutate, then it disappears because almost everybody has been infected and they're all immune, or else everyone's all vaccinated. And so the only way it can survive at all is to be below the radar. That is to become another flu virus, which are also under the radar and controlled by vaccines. And so we're not sure, but these are possible scenarios as to how this epidemic may eventually end. And now I'd like to actually bring on our next guest, Dr. Carl Zimmer, who'll talk to us about life, about evolution, because in some sense, that's what it's all about. The evolution of life, life on the earth, the evolution of human beings. And Dr. Carl Zimmer is the author of a new book called Evolution. So let's take a short commercial break. And after the break, we're going to continue a discussion about life, specifically Darwin's theory of evolution, which in some sense is dominating the headlines even today with the coronavirus. Well, that concludes the first half of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. We've been talking about the coronavirus and the enormous impact that it's had on all our lives. But in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about life. Yes, life will endure. Life will evolve. And we'll talk to Dr. Carl Zimmer, author of an exciting new book called Evolution. And so that's right. In the second half, we're going to talk about the brighter side of things. We're going to be talking about life and evolution. Well, once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics. In the first half of Exploration, we talked about the tragedy of the coronavirus, specifically the science behind the greatest plague in our lifetime. But in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the other side of nature, and that is evolution. With us today is Dr. Carl Zimmer, He's a biologist, writes for Discover Magazine and New York Times and many other periodicals, and he's the author of a new book, aptly called Evolution. And so once again, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to celebrate life rather than talking about death and the plague. We're going to talk about the other side of nature, and that is evolution with Dr. Carl Zimmer.
He's the author of many acclaimed books, and his latest book is called simply Evolution. And perhaps the most intriguing aspect of all this debate is how this applies to human beings. You know, when Charles Darwin first published Origin of Species, it created quite a splash. It was a sellout. However, he refrained from talking about the evolution of humans. But to him, it was obvious that humans are, well, in some sense, like animals, and that many of the parts of our body evolved from the parts of the bodies of our neighboring species, for example, the great apes. And Charles Darwin even put a place where humanity evolved from, and that is Africa. So why did Charles Darwin select Africa as the birthplace of human beings? Before then, some anthropologists said that perhaps Europe was the cradle of all of humanity. In fact, that's why the word Caucasian has an origin. Some people thought that the Caucasus Mountains was the origin of humanity. Charles Darwin said, no, it's Africa, because that's where you find species that look like us, the apes. In Africa, you see so many varieties of monkeys. And if we evolved from a certain species, there were probably neighboring species simultaneously existing with us. And that's why he selected Africa as the cradle of humanity. Well, you can imagine that even today, 150 years after Darwin's theory, it's still controversial. Even though Darwin's theory is the foundation of modern medicine, you cannot practice modern medicine today and do research without understanding evolutionary theory, the theory of DNA, and how it applies to all of us. So in other words, the miracles of modern medicine depend on the theory of evolution by Charles Darwin. Well, Carl Sagan had a book years ago talking about the brain. And, maybe you can comment on this. He had a theory that there are three layers to the brain. The back of the brain he called the reptilian brain, because the brain in some sense is a museum of all the early stages of our evolution. And we originally came from the reptiles. So at the very base of the brain is a very simple reptilian brain. Then he said the center of the brain is the limbic system, the emotional brain, the monkey brain, the social brain. And then the front part of our brain is what really makes reasoning and abstract thought possible. And that's the cerebral cortex. And that's what makes us human. Has this held up? That book by Carl Sagan was quite a few years ago. Has that pretty much held up that the human brain in some sense has an evolutionary heritage from the animal kingdom?
In the basic outlines, yes. Three-part theory of the brain came up in the 1950s. It was originally proposed by Dr. Paul MacLean. Neurologists now look at it as a little too simple a version of what was happening. There's not one distinct reptile part of our brain, but certainly you can see the evolutionary heritage of our past in our brains, and particularly in the way our brains develop. I mean, for example, the first vertebrates looked like sort of sardines without a head. They just had a little spinal cord with a slightly swollen tip at the end. But you can actually look at the genes that are expressed as that tip of the spinal cord starts to form in these funny little fish, and you see that actually they're the same genes that help to structure our own brain, and they play a lot of the same roles. So you can see a 500 million year history of our brains in the way that our brains develop and the similarities between our brains and the brains of other animals.
Okay, well, you have an article in the latest issue of Discover Magazine called Where Are We Going? Why Are Our Brains So Big? who was the first human, why do we walk upright, and other great mysteries of human evolution. So let's start the story about 6 to 7 million years ago in Africa, when many scientists think that we first began to split off from the chimpanzees and the apes. So tell us a little bit about the evidence for what happened in Africa 6 to 7 million years ago, and why did we split off?
There are two primary kinds of evidence that you can look at. One is fossils. And if you look for fossils of hominids, that is, apes that are more closely related to us than to other living apes, you can find hominids all over the old world going back about a million years. And then further back, it gets a little harder to find, a little harder. Before about a million and a half years, they're all in Africa. And then the oldest one that's been found is somewhere between 6 and 7 million years old that was found in the Sahara, and it's called Sahelanthropus. It was actually just announced last year, so it's quite a tremendous discovery and really a very important one. So you have that as our oldest evidence of hominid evolution going on in Africa. But you can also look at another kind of evidence. You can look at the evidence in our own DNA. You can compare our DNA to the DNA of other apes. So our closest living relatives are chimpanzees and bonobos, which look like chimpanzees, but they're actually a different species. Anyway, they're basically sort of our first cousins. And if you compare our DNA to theirs, it's astonishingly similar. If you look at the parts of the human genome where there's a code for proteins, the difference is very hard to find between them, as different as we may look on the outside. In fact, they are about 99.4% identical. So obviously we're very closely related to chimpanzees. And so you can then look at those differences to try to figure out how it is that we split off and what makes us uniquely human. And you can then look at the DNA of people in Africa and people in Asia, people in Europe, and you can see that the root of the family tree, of the human family tree, is in Africa. So we all came out of Africa.
And I understand that DNA is also a clock, that we know more or less the rate at which mutations build up within DNA. And given that rate, we could then calculate when we split off from different other species of life on the Earth. Could you elaborate?
Sure. Yeah. Over time, a species genome picks up little mutations, and a lot of those mutations actually don't bring much harm or much benefit. They just kind of pile up in the background. And so they seem to pile up at a pretty steady rate. The rate may change from species to species, but there are ways of figuring out what that rate is. So if you then look at human DNA and chimpanzee DNA and gorilla DNA and orangutan DNA, and then kind of line it all up and calculate the clock, you can get an estimate of how long ago the ancestors of, say, chimpanzees and humans diverged. And this is really just starting to come together now, these molecular clock estimates, because you need a lot of data. You need to look at a lot of gene sequences. And so there are, for example, recent estimates that humans and chimpanzees, their ancestors diverged, say, about 5 million years ago, plus or minus a million years. So that still overlaps with what the fossil evidence says, and it also helps to show just how closely related humans and chimpanzees are.
Okay, now one of the big questions, why did we separate off from the chimpanzee line or the common line? What benefit did it give us? And so tell us a little bit about what happened when we first began to diverge from our cousins.
Right. Well, this is sort of the mystery of mysteries. This is the question that everybody wants an answer to, scientists included. And it's hard to really get a good answer for it when you don't have as much evidence as you'd like to work with. I mean, this fossil I told you about, Sahelanthropus, incredibly important fossil. But when you look at it, really, it's basically consists of some fragments of the skull and a few bones from the rest of the skeleton, and that's about it. You know, you need so much more information to really get good answers to that. But you know, you can make some hypotheses, and then you can test them in the future. So you know, there used to be this thought that, well, you know, since we're humans and we're so wonderful and so special and so unique, that there must have been some incredibly profound reason that we diverged from other apes, which must be very stupid and inferior. So people would look for reasons that would be sort of sufficient. So, for example, there was an idea that the jungles began to dry up in East Africa, and then you had the savanna, and so that our ancestors sort of strode out into the savanna, became bipedal, could walk on two legs, and therefore became totally different from other chimpanzees, other apes, I should say. The problem is that the earliest hominids didn't live in savannas, that they lived in woodlands, dense woodlands or light woodlands, but in any case, not these savannas. So that whole kind of theory falls apart. You know, there may have been other reasons that we began to diverge. You know, we didn't live in dense jungles anymore, so, you know, maybe we needed to sort of walk from tree to tree and pull down fruits that were hanging from those trees, or maybe just to stand up in a tree to pick fruit. It's not a very heroic kind of scenario, but, you know, huge changes in evolution are often based on these tiny little shifts in diet or other ways of getting a living.
Okay, so now we begin to walk on 2 feet for whatever reason, and that, of course, freed up our hand. So tell us a little bit about our hand and our thumb. Why do we have thumbs anyway, and what are thumbs good for?
Well, you know, obviously other apes have thumbs, and but they look a lot different than ours. I mean, we can, you know, you can touch your fingertips with your thumbs, which gives you a huge amount of dexterity. You can do all sorts of things with your hands thanks to the way that your thumbs are arranged. There must be some connection between the changes that happened in the human hand and things that you would use that kind of a hand for, most importantly, making tools. So the question then becomes, well, what is the history of tools? And that's another pretty murky question. The oldest evidence of hominid tools is 2.6 million years old. These are stone tools. When I say tool, I don't mean a power saw or something. I just mean basically a chipped stone that you could use to, like, break open a bone and get the marrow out, or butcher a carcass to get some meat off that you couldn't get with your fingers or your mouth. Now, before that, there could have been other tools that just weren't preserved in the fossil record. And an important thing that scientists now recognize is that chimpanzees and other apes are not dumb, and this extends to using tools. So, for example, chimpanzees can make all sorts of tools. They can make sandals out of leaves. They can make little hats. They can fish termites out of nests. They can do all sorts of things. They can even use stone tools, although they can't use them. They can't manufacture them the way we can. So there might have been a long sort of prehistory of tool making that we only start to see about 2.6 million years ago.
And now let's, of course, talk about the brain. It used to be thought that because we're smart, then we use tools. But if the human brain developed relatively late on this scale, then perhaps it was the other way around. Perhaps tools helped to make us, in the sense that those chimpanzees or ape-like animals that could use tools had a better survival advantage over those cousins that did not have the ability to use tools. So tell us now a little bit about, when did the brain start to get larger? And the big question is, what are your thoughts about why?
Well, talking about the brain, people often think that all that happened in human evolution is that it got big, like, there, you know, you stuck an air pump in the skull and just pumped it up, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, certainly, the human brain is enormous. You know, mammals generally kind of follow a general pattern of the relationship of their brain size to their body size. We humans don't fit into that pattern. Our brains are about 7 times too big for our body size if we were a normal mammal. So clearly we have big brains, but we also have brains that are different in other ways. I mean, they have a different kind of organization. So some regions of the brain in humans are bigger than in chimpanzees. Some are smaller. There's a different kind of wiring that goes on. We're only just starting to figure out what those differences are. So a big important question is, well, was there some sort of reorganization going on in the small hominid brain before it started becoming big? Because the brains only start to become big in the fossil record around 2 million years ago. So this is well over 500,000 years after we start seeing the first stone tools. So, you know, what was going on before then, it's hard to say. Now, there are a lot of different theories that, you know, some of your listeners may remember from your previous shows that people have put forward about why brains got big. One is sort of the peacock theory, that it's a kind of way of attracting mates in the same way that a peacock uses its tail to attract female peacocks. There's another idea that sort of it's called Machiavellian intelligence, named after Machiavelli, in the sense that our ancestors were just trying to figure out what everybody else was thinking and trying to manipulate them for their own ends. There are other ideas about, for example, parasites. Lots of different theories. I think that one of the most interesting ways of thinking about it is to think about kind of the home life of a hominid 2 million years ago. You know, they by then you're starting to get much more towards a sort of savanna kind of existence, and you've got these bands of hominids moving around together, and now they've got tools and they can get different kinds of things with their tools. They can dig up roots, for example, which have tubers that have lots of energy in them. They can get at lots of food stuff. But you need to be an adult to get that stuff. And what you can do is bring it home and feed your kids. So now your kids aren't having to go scrounge for food themselves. They can get this wonderful amount of food from their parents. This provides an opportunity for the evolution of bigger brains, because the more energy can be sort of dedicated to growing these big brains than to just kind of, you know, getting out of the family and looking for food yourself. So I kind of like to look at the kind of the kitchen side of the equation.
Okay, well let's talk about some more theories. There are a whole bunch of theories about why we became intelligent. When we look at cheetahs and antelopes, we find that they are delicately crafted to excel at high accelerations very quickly. And so why is it that the cheetah and certain antelopes are such finely crafted, aerodynamically stable animals? And, well, we realize there's an arms race going on between predators and prey. So perhaps there was an arms race among humans. But of course, humans aren't competing against anyone. There are no more Neanderthals out there. So who are we competing against? Perhaps we're competing against ourselves, other tribes, other groups of humans. And therefore, there was a selection pressure because we competed against other humans. What are your thoughts?
This is a really interesting area of research that's going on right now, and it's fascinating to watch it develop. It pulls in a lot of elements from psychology, even from economics. There are all sorts of ways of understanding this process, and a lot of people think this may be really a key to understanding this transition in human evolution, in the sense that you do have these different groups. You have bands that were roaming around, maybe 100, 150 strong, that would be competing for resources with other bands. You see this going on with chimpanzees today. Well, they will wage little battles with each other for, you know, the good fruit trees, for example. So the question then becomes, well, what makes for a good group? What makes for a group that's going to be able to hold together, that's going to be able to compete against these other groups? And so, you know, what that may involve may be a sort of a really good social intelligence. In other words, being able to work cooperatively, being able to understand what other people are thinking in order to work together to hunt, for example, or to fight off an intruder, for example. So you could be getting this kind of group selection, as it's called, where certain groups are favored over other kinds of groups. And that, in turn, would influence who gets to reproduce and who doesn't. And that would actually influence the shape of our brain. And, you know, built into this is something else really interesting. It's morality. If you look at apes, they do have sort of basic moral systems. They have a sense of fairness, and they punish each other for breaking certain social rules. It could be that our much more elaborate sense of morality emerged as these groups were competing with each other. So morality would keep a group cohesive, even as people were kind of competing with each other for mates and so on. It would keep these groups from falling apart.
Okay, and yet there's another theory, sort of a spin-off of the peacock theory. If you take a look at humans, we are much more intelligent than necessary. We don't have to understand calculus, and we don't understand how to go to the moon. All we have to do is survive in the forest. And if you take a look at peacocks, of course, peacocks' feathers are totally unnecessary. So it is the female that chooses males who are extra healthy, who can afford to have these feathers. And so this other theory says that it is the woman, the female, who decides that she wants to have a smart man. Now, if you take a look at dating habits, most women say that, yeah, they want a man who's smart. Who wants to date a man who's not so smart? They could be taken advantage of. And if you take a look at high school, a lot of the women there seem to prefer the quarterback over the halfback. So it's not necessarily the muscles. It's the social smarts that are important in that game. Well, that's a theory. What are your thoughts?
It's definitely an interesting theory because sexual selection is very important in the animal world. I mean, that's what does give us the peacock tail. It's what gives us the rooster's comb. It gives us all these sorts of extravagant displays. I'm a little skeptical about the theory just because there haven't been that many sort of rigorous tests of it. I mean, and you can think of some counterexamples that would have to be addressed. I mean, it's true that some girls might like to date the quarterback as opposed to the rest of the football team, but the rest of the football team probably does pretty well in terms of getting dates. And, you know, if it's intelligence that we're talking about, then, you know, why is it that that guy in the computer lab isn't getting any dates at all? It's an interesting idea, but I'm waiting to see sort of how it emerges.
Okay. Now, when I was watching the movie The X-Men the other day, it was mentioned that Homo sapiens coexisted with the Neanderthals, and that recent DNA evidence showed that we actually mated with the Neanderthals. However, I think that the DNA evidence seems to indicate the opposite. So tell us a little bit about the Neanderthals and the fact that we coexisted with them, and that DNA, in fact, has been extracted from the Neanderthals.
Neanderthals, as far as paleontologists can determine, probably descend from a common species. Neanderthals, as far as we can tell, descend from a common ancestor that lived somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 years ago. Now, our ancestors remained in Africa. The Neanderthals and their ancestors moved out of Africa and into the Near East and into Europe. And they survived there for what looks to be several hundred thousand years. They had brains as big as ours or bigger. They were incredibly strong and rugged. They were master hunters. They don't seem to have displayed the kind of creativity that our ancestors did. They seem to be pretty much set in their ways in terms of how they made tools and how they hunted and so on. But that worked pretty well. I mean, they survived ice ages that would have killed most of us. But the question then is, well, what happened to Neanderthals? It used to be thought that Neanderthals just became modern Europeans. that it was just a process of evolution that steadily led from Neanderthals to Europeans. That's not looking to be the case now. Now it looks like that Neanderthals became extinct, that Africans came out of Africa maybe, say, 50,000 years ago, 50 to 70,000 years ago, and started replacing the species that they encountered, like Neanderthals. Now, there's been a lot of talk about, well, maybe Neanderthals were able to interbreed with our ancestors, with what are called modern humans. And, you know, this pops up in things like X-Men, for example. Well, you can actually look at Neanderthal DNA if you find a particularly well-preserved skull or other fossil of Neanderthals. And scientists have actually found four different samples of Neanderthal DNA, and they've been able to compare the genes there with the genes of modern humans. And it turns out, if you look at the sort of family tree you can draw with that information, the Neanderthals are all going off on their own branch. They're not more closely related to Europeans than they are to Asians, for example. So it really does look like they're off on their own. Now, if you look at the bones of Neanderthals and the bones of some of the earliest Europeans, you do see some evidence that maybe there was some interbreeding. Sometimes you see a modern human that has a really kind of rugged-looking jaw. There was one that was just recently reported that's 37,000 years ago, 37,000 years old in Romania, and it has a kind of a Neanderthal look to it, even though it's clearly a modern human. So maybe there was a little interbreeding going on. But if there was, that didn't mean that that there was that much going on, as the gene suggests.
And that completes our interview with Carl Zimmer. He's a science writer, writes for Discover magazine. He's the author of the book Evolution, and we have been talking about the human brain and the origins of human evolution. In light of some rather remarkable fossil discoveries and also DNA work, which helps to pin down the origins of the human race. And so once again, the author was Carl Zimmer, author of the book Evolution.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. This is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. Good day.